Hi, I'm Bill Arnold with George Fraser.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for checking out this podcast, A Real Recovery. You can hear the show live Sundays at 5 p.m. This, as well as many other podcasts, are available to listen to while you take a walk or do whatever you want to do. The address is myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. Nice to have you here. Welcome to Real Recovery. It's Sunday night, 5 o'clock. It's happy hour. We're glad you're here to join us for the happiest hour on radio. This is Bill Arnold across the studio, a man banishing self-doubt and who still believes ramen noodles is fine dining. George Fraser. Hello, George.
Bill, how are you tonight?
I'm good. You know, I've got a sore shoulder, and my doctor said lately that I've been overdoing moderation. But, you know, I don't know what to say about that.
It's a chronic problem for you.
It is. It is. You know, you have a host of problems that you talk to doctors about. I'm a little claustrophobic, but I realize I'm only claustrophobic in tight, confined spaces. So I got my own mental issues.
Progress is being made on
progress
the other end of this.
Being made.
No euphemisms for you this week.
Yeah, George, we got a great show, and I first want to say hi to Alex.
Hello.
Alex is on the board. How are you this week?
I am fantastic.
Yeah, your summer's going well, I take it.
Yeah, very well.
Yeah, from last week when we talked to you. Nothing's changed.
Yeah,
isn't that nice, George?
It is nice. Yeah, we can rely on that.
George, we have with us tonight on the radio, on the phone, Heather Kopp is back.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just pumping up the energy here.
You are?
Yeah, Heather Kopp is back with us. I'm so excited.
You had the network thing going.
I did, yes. Yeah, but we had Heather on the show about a year and a half ago, and I called her and I said, we have added 3 new listeners since last time. We got to have you back on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And some of those listeners are my relatives, my uncles, who are listening for the first time tonight. So welcome to the show.
Oh, gosh, that's great. I read that book. It was fabulous. Pictures next time. It's tough for me to read, but it was a great book.
Yeah, the book, George, do you recall what it's called? It's called Sober Mercies. It's called Sober Mercies, How Love Caught Up with a Christian Drunk. She's author of more than 24 nonfiction titles, and she is, I'm a big fan. I'm looking forward to hearing from her tonight, and I know you will. The listening audience will enjoy her as well. George, we on Real Recovery talk about recovery from addictions, and, you know, tell our listeners exactly what we try to do every week.
Well, we talk about recovery from addictions, but Bill, recovery from ourselves, our old selves. If we're a Christian, we've been made anew, and our life should be different. And we all have issues. We have idols. Maybe it's money, maybe it's food, maybe it's gambling, maybe it's alcohol. And we put those, they're God's substitutes, Bill. So if we stop a behavior, we still need to develop that relationship with Jesus Christ. I like the title Sober Mercies, Billy, because here's what it is. Nobody gets sober because they want to. God has to change your heart. Let's face it. We have problems from our use. Everybody wants us to quit using but us. And one day we do want to quit using. That has to come from God. We do a step out of the 12 steps every week. And tonight we're on step 11, Bill. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. We have a purpose and a reason why we are here. It's not just to stop drinking and stay out of trouble. Our purpose is to glorify God. We have a glory-seeking God. We were created to glorify Him. And God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. So when people see somebody, we were talking about a guy earlier who's celebrating a sobriety anniversary today. They see a changed person. What happened? What happened in your life? Well, Jesus did. And that's our opportunity, Bill. We want to kind of look back a little bit. These steps go together. All the steps, we don't just do one and we're done. Last week we talked about step 10, where we continue to take our inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Where have I been resentful? Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been afraid? I don't know about you guys, but for me, that only happens every day, all the time. I'm prone to be dishonest. I'm prone to be selfish. I'm prone to be resentful, and I'm prone to be afraid. And what I want to do is do what Jesus created me to do. I have to get on my knees every day and say, what do you want me to do today? What is God's will for your life, Bill? Do you know?
To obey Him, to follow Him.
Yes.
Yeah. God's love for you is not based on your ability to change, but on what Christ did on the cross for us.
And how do we find out what His will is for us on a daily basis? We have to spend time in the Word And we have to pray for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out, because we are kind of prone to do our own thing, aren't we?
Yep. George, step 11 now, it says you improve your conscious contact with God, right?
Conscious,
yeah. So Jesus heals what's in us and what's between us, right? Because
okay.
He is the one that does that. And do you feel accepted by God?
Sure.
Okay, excellent. And then what about, have you had a problem with authority figures in your life?
Always.
Is God the ultimate authority figure?
Sure. I don't want anybody telling me what to do.
I get that. But so if God's the ultimate authority figure, do you also struggle with him?
Sure.
Okay. Have you ever cried out, why can't I change? Why can't I do this better?
Golf course yesterday.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Sure.
I'm not sure that counts.
I think.
But does it lead to the struggle with your own sense of self-worth?
I've never really had a problem with that. Where I have the problem is, why do I want to be so strong-willed? That's my problem.
Hmm.
Not about self-worth, about not being good enough. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I want to do it right now, and I want to do a lot of it. That's George's problem.
Okay.
But I think for all of us, we need to identify where it is. We're trying to be away from God, because if I really do submit and obey God, I lose myself. Boy, that's tough. But really, you find the self where you were created to be. Fair?
Fair. George, I know it's, I've heard people say you don't know what you have until it's gone.
But I take paradise and you put up a parking lot.
That's a song of some kind, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joni Mitchell, wasn't it?
Yeah, I should have known that. But let me finish my thought here.
Okay.
I will not let you take me off my train here.
Plagiarism works on this show. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. That people say that you don't know really what you have till it's gone. But I think that you knew what you had, but you just thought you'd never lose it. I think that's part of the arrogance and part of the pride that people have.
I'm not used to coming on the show and having to think, but I think you have a good point there. The other thing is, there's an unknown that we're sure isn't going to be as good as what we have. What do I mean by that? If I quit drinking, Bill, even though it's destroying me, there's no way this is going to be better. Is it possible that we're wrong? Is it possible we don't have all the facts? Is it possible we can't figure God out? Yes, yes, and yes.
Mm-hmm. Nice work.
We have to admit that we don't know everything.
All right, George, if we talk about just our struggle with our self-worth, because people that get caught up in addiction, they try real hard and they fail, and then they feel shameful and guilty, so they try harder, then they fail. There's a cycle of dysfunction.
Absolutely.
On and on and on. Okay. And then
that does happen for a lot of people.
I get that.
Yeah.
Does it then turn into people struggling with their ability to thrive in life? I think there's a complete lack of a person's ability to thrive. And when you're not thriving, you feel like a victim and you're in despair. And it's so easy to return to the behavior that helped you change the way you feel and make you feel better.
Exactly. We're talking about survival there, Bill. And the one thing that I think is allowing me to survive, you're asking me to give up. When you asked me earlier about the problems, for a lot of people it can be self-esteem. It's different from other people. But is there a shame with any addict who's gone through the cycle of addiction? You bet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm okay with guilt. Guilt is feeling bad about what you do, and when it violates your moral code, it can get your barometer back that you can change this anytime you want with the help of Christ. That's good. But shame is feeling bad about who we are as a human, your humanity, that if you don't bathe every day, you stink and you feel bad about that. That isn't good. Jesus can wipe away your shame, because you were created to be a child of God, and there is no shame in that. Where we're getting our message from is the wrong place. We've got to get into the Word and see what Jesus said, that he died for us because he loves us, and he wants to forgive us, and he wants to enable us to change. Through the power of the Holy Spirit, you can change. You never give up.
You're on fire tonight there, Mr. F. Yeah.
No, I think it's really important, and I've been there, what you're talking about,
okay.
Where I can't quit. I'm dying, but what I'm holding on to keep me alive is actually killing me. There's
right.
a delusion there.
Right. And I return to this verse often, because I think this is a verse that this show loves.
Proverbs?
Yes, Proverbs 19:3. People ruin their lives by their own foolishness and then are angry at the Lord. Hello?
Well, you're looking at me, and I agree with you.
Yeah. And sin often prefers to disguise itself as something you think you deserve. Don't you agree?
Absolutely.
You come home, you've had a rough day, I deserve this.
All my sins are fun, Bill.
Right. I deserve this. I should have that. And people end up with addictions that define their lives.
Well, and our relapses. How many guys have relapsed that told you, well, I thought one more time, or I thought I deserved it, or I could handle it this
right.
time?
Right. It's the I can handle it is what I heard more. What's what I hear the most.
Okay.
But we need to be defined by Christ and live in freedom that comes from the slavery of addictions. So we're going to take a little short break here coming up in 30 seconds, and then we're going to bring on Heather Kopp. And for more than 12 years, Heather was a Christian drunk, living a double life. And by day, she wrote books about parenting and prayer, and by night, she drank herself blotto, as she would put it.
Sure.
From a stash she kept in her closet, and she would often hide her liquor in her boots. Now she says she has sober boots. You know, you sometimes say, you know, you shouldn't criticize anyone until you walk a mile in their boots. I think with Heather's problem, you could never get them on.
Yeah. Cue Nancy Sinatra. Where's there.
Do we not have a rim shot on this
do we
show?
No,
Nancy
sorry.
Alex, job for next week. Get us a rim shot. All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Heather Kopp is up on the studio line. Listen to Real Recovery, Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex on the board. Be back in a minute. Everybody to Real Recovery, Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Recovery from Addictions, a subject that has broad appeal, hosted by two guys with limited appeal. We've got a great show tonight, George. We have Heather Kopp with us tonight, and she has written a book called Sober Mercies, and she is making a return appearance to Real Recovery. So welcome back to the show, Heather.
Hey, thanks for having me back again.
Well, we are so delighted. Your book has touched so many just in my little circle. I was able to get it on the photocopy machine and make a number of copies.
Awesome. Awesome. You owe me royalty.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I'm kidding. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear that.
So what I love about one of the many things I love about your writing is you love to just drill down to the bare bones, and you love to be honest, and you love to be clear. And you love to share brokenness.
Oh, I hope so. That is true. That's true. I think that, you know, too often we are trying to hide the stuff that we feel ashamed about. And, you know, there's so much healing that happens through sharing that. In fact, you know, in recovery community, you know, when we are in some kind of a program or meeting and we share with each other, you know, I've often been sitting or listening to people share their dark stuff and realizing, oh, this is a process of we are de-shaming these old incidents by sharing them and then sharing them in a way that can help others. And it's sort of like washing off the shame.
I like that a lot. One of the things that happens is when we do that, we realize we're not unique. That there's humanity. And for the person speaking, Heather, that's great. It's very therapeutic. But there's other people listening around that's going, that's me. That's me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's so helpful, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I think that's why, you know, community and talking, and even the community that you're creating here on the radio, you know, that is so healing because we do need that reassurance that we're not alone. And we need the sense of connection. Somebody understands me. They get it. It's huge.
Heather, this might be an odd segue, but on your bio and on your website, I read a little something about your dog, Edmund. And every time you come through the door, he just barks wildly at you, and he's so excited. And you basically said to him, you know, hey, you belong to me, stupid. You're supposed to bark at strangers.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, but the truth is, you said that you're not good at barking at strangers either. So he says, you know, that went on to say that, you know, you bark at people that you belong to.
Oh, that's the truth, don't we all?
Goodness, why
we do that? We bark at the people that it's because we feel safe to bark at them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my dog, I think, is just pure stupid, but I think with us human beings, we somehow feel permission to treat the people that are most precious to us. You know, sometimes a little bit rudely. But also there's the flip side of that is that we get to be honest, you know. And in my case, I couldn't be honest with the people that were closest to me in my own life. I mean, I was hiding my alcoholism from my own husband for 12 years and doing a lot of work. It was like a part-time job to do that, you know. So, he knew that I had a drinking problem, but he had no idea just how bad it was.
Can you take us on a little journey of that 12 years? I think that's approximately what it was. You were busy as an editor, and you were editing manuscripts and books for pastors and teachers, then at night you would drink.
Drink, yeah. Yeah, that's basically what happened is when I married Dave, I began working with him a lot in Christian publishing, and I had written some books before that, but began working more with other authors and editing. And, you know, we kind of got into a habit of drinking every night with dinner, and it was just sort of this civilized thing to do. And it also became the great reward, like the stress reliever, and we've earned this, you know. And I noticed, though, really quickly that Dave could drink a glass of wine or a glass and a half, and he would have wanted to drink just like me, and he would feel done. And I would have a glass of wine, and I would be 10 times more thirsty for that wine to have more than I was before I even got the glass. And I couldn't understand it. I didn't understand alcoholism, and I didn't understand that phenomenon of craving that kicks in, that is something that happens in an alcoholic that's just different than what happens with a non-alcoholic. And so, yeah, he began to get all judgmental, you know, and then I realized, oh, the problem is Dave. He's just a stick in the mud, and if I just hide part of what I drink, he doesn't need to know. I bet he won't even notice. and I subscribed. You know, I knew the Bible said, you know, don't be drunk, but be drunk with the Holy Spirit, be filled with the Holy Spirit. You know, so that was my measure, is I won't get drunk. And I discovered that you can drink an astonishing amount of alcohol without being technically drunk. And what does drunk mean? Well, I'm not falling down on the floor, you know. So with that, using that measure and sort of justifying it that, oh, I'm doing this to protect Dave's little conscience by drinking extra without him knowing, of course, that was just the beginning of a very long descent. And pretty soon, I could not go a day without drinking. And of course, with tolerance, you know, as an alcoholic, the more I drank, the more I needed to drink over time to get the same feelings. And so, yeah, it just got out of control really quickly, and I began to have to keep this stash in my closet and hiding it in my purse. You know, so if I'm at a restaurant and we order a bottle of wine, well, that's not nearly enough, you know, for me to have half a bottle of wine. So I would have to go to the ladies' room and have those little bottles in my purse, you know, and drink those. And it got really ugly by the end. By the end of my drinking, I was blacking out a lot. I couldn't remember the previous evening. I couldn't remember what I did or said. And I would start to take notes in my journal at night in secret while drinking so that in the morning I could find these notes and I could read them and try to pretend to Dave that I remembered the previous evening. That's how bad it got. And it also got so bad that, you know, I was physically attacking Dave. We were having such bad fights that I would go into fits of rage. The next morning I wouldn't remember, and I'd come downstairs and see scratch marks on my husband and bruises. That was toward the very end, and that's just how bad it got.
How preoccupied were you during the day with when you could start drinking? Did that become a problem for you, too?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, I made it a point of pride, though, because, you know, I'm not going to drink in the morning. If I don't drink until, like, 4 o'clock, then I can't be an alcoholic, or it's not a problem, you know. And so that was sort of my thing, is I wasn't one of those people who woke up in the morning and drank, but I would start at around 4 and I couldn't wait till that time and to start drinking. And that was the big reward for the day, and it became sort of the reason to even get up and keep going and doing life. And I felt like I couldn't do anything hard without alcohol, like laundry, bills, you know. If there was something hard I needed to do, well, drinking made it bearable, you know. And that was my mindset. So you can imagine that my my fear of going even a day or a night without alcohol was so great that the thought of getting sober or ever being able to quit was incomprehensible to me, because I would be in torment by 7 o'clock every night. How could I possibly become someone who doesn't drink every day? You know, that was my mindset.
Well, we kind of get into a position, Bill, where everybody wants us to quit but us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that's
absolutely.
A real lonely place to be, because the powerlessness isn't just in not being able to stop. It's the idea that I cannot live without this. That's the worst powerlessness, I think, don't you? I'm talking to you.
Me.
Sorry.
Me,
yeah,
okay.
He would always prefer to talk to you.
Yes.
He would always prefer that.
I have to have Bill in here because it's part of his show, too, but I was talking to you on that. I apologize. But isn't that the most powerless part?
Oh, there's so much despair in that. There is so much despair. And I think that for Christians, that despair and that powerlessness is in some ways worse than the person who's not a Christian, because I truly loved God, and I truly, you know, it's not like as I became an alcoholic, yes, I'm living this double life because no one knows, but deep down I'm still journaling and I still am trying to help people through the books I'm working on or writing. And I mean, I genuinely still managed to love God, and a lot of people don't understand that. How can you say you love God and then be getting drunk every night? Well, you take it one day at a time, the same way we stay sober. And every single morning you say, I repent. I can't believe I did that. God, help me only drink two, you know. And then you get to the place where you just know that you're an alcoholic, because it gets so bad that you realize, okay, this is not normal. And then at that point, you know, I stopped asking God to help me control it, and I just began to pray for absolute deliverance. I wanted the miracle, and I wanted it on my terms, in private, and I wanted God to just zap me. And I would wake up, and 4 o'clock would come, and I wouldn't want to drink. Or I would be able to make it through a whole night, and then maybe a whole nother day. And so I prayed for this private miracle that would happen. And it didn't, and it didn't. And that was just devastating. And I just couldn't figure out what's going to happen. Am I going to kill somebody on the road? Because I was driving, you know, having drunk. I drove, not a lot, but I drove with my kids in the car when I was drunk. And I just couldn't see where this was all going to end, because by then I realized it's getting so bad that I can hardly keep up with finding all the empties and hiding them in the bottom of the garbage. And I started making mistakes, you know, and I was sick. I was always felt sick, physically sick and tired, and I could hardly write anymore. And for me, that miracle never happened. And now, in retrospect, I'm so grateful that it didn't happen. What happened instead, because see, I had so much pride and so much ego, and I thought, if anyone ever knew the truth, I would literally die of the shame. I would die of the shame. I couldn't possibly think about getting help or going to treatment. I'm a Christian writer. I would just die of the shame. And it felt like, you know, a betrayal of Christ's work on the cross to even say I'm addicted. It felt like, to me, like saying, God, this God thing doesn't work. I became an alcoholic, you know? So I had a lot of things that were very mixed up. And in my case, when I finally had that surrender by my bed, where I'm wailing and crying out to God, the miracle that happened wasn't being, you know, saved cold turkey from alcohol. It was finally a willingness to tell the truth and then to reach for help and to let my pride be destroyed.
Bill, that gift of desperation is a gift, because we don't get there on our own, and God allows us to. And with that gift of desperation comes the answer.
Yeah, and she's obviously gotten over the anxiety of sharing her pain, because we are on live radio right now, and she's just blabbed it out.
Well, you know, that's the bizarre miracle of it. It was, you know, after I came out and told my husband the whole truth and became willing to get help and admit this, and not care, finally, what people thought. It was the opposite of what I pictured. I thought that I was going to die of shame, and instead, that's what freed me from shame. And I couldn't believe how thoroughly, you know, the shame was tied to the secrecy and the hiding. And once I came out from that, I was so shocked to discover, oh, now I feel relief and I don't care what people think. And I'm able to just, it was just this huge relief, because once you're at the bottom and you've given up your pride, you don't have any pride to hurt. You're just so free because you're so at the bottom. It's a beautiful place to be.
Thinking you're fooling people with your drinking is pretty funny, isn't it?
In the beginning it is. And I thought I was pretty smart. And you know what? I grew up as a sneak. And I was that kid in the family. I was always the one sneaking the last ding-dong from the box so the other kids wouldn't get it. And I was just a sneak and a liar, and it was every man for himself. And so for me, I realized, even after I got sober, I realized half the time when I did feel craving or did struggle, it was like, yes, it was a struggle for alcohol, but mostly I missed sneaking. I missed the urge, and I missed the feeling that I'm getting away with something. I'm getting away with something because of that inner thing in us that wants to get ours and get more and get away with something. At least for me, that was a big issue with the sneakiness.
It's a good thing you didn't grow up in George's family, because you would end up with crushed fingers going for that last ding-dong. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have lots more with Heather Kopp. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser, Alex on the board. Be back in just a minute. Thanks. And his head fell behind. Welcome back to Real Recovery. So glad you're joining us tonight. It's a beautiful Sunday night in the upper Midwest, and we're glad to still be enjoying summer. George, we are talking to Heather Kopp tonight, and she's written a book called Sober Mercies. And she is honest and bold, even though I don't know what the word bold means. You heard that? It's a word that gets overused. It's a bold look. It's a bold styling. It's bold stance. What does that mean?
Are you asking me?
I
better ask you, because George has given me the big blank look.
Blank stare.
Yeah.
No, I'm giving him the blank stare. What does bold mean to you, Heather? Passed that along, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
Good
Thank
question.
You,
yeah.
You know, that's a good question.
But don't you hear that all the time,
usually,
Heather?
I don't usually think of myself so much as bold as I do hoping that I have courage to be authentic and in the moment, and real, and honest.
But that produces boldness.
Honesty produces boldness, and when you feel like you are connected to God, you're willing to be honest, then you're not so afraid to speak, and you can say things with conviction, and that appears to be boldness.
Yeah, on Christ the solid rock I stand. Bill, I think when we know we're in God's will, we tie it into step 11, doing what he says for us to do, there is boldness. But when you're using and you're lying and you're being deceptive, you're not bold. You're afraid, because somebody's going to find out about you.
True, true. Heather, here's a question that we would love answered. How did you hold this conflict in your brain? On one side, you're an editor editing Christian books, and on the other side, you're struggling with alcoholism. How did you hold that conflict in your head? And how did you resolve it? More important.
Yeah. What I did is I got really cynical about all the Christians and pastors and everyone that I worked with in the evangelical world. And I decided that I focused on everyone else's hypocrisies. and I know that sounds just hilarious that, you know, because I'm the biggest hypocrite of all. But I think because of that, I became very cynical and bitter. And because I worked in Christian publishing with a lot of pastors with big egos, I just had a lot of opportunities to sort of find fault with everyone and focus on that. And I think that's part of what I did. I think, you know, the other thing that I did is I didn't deal with it very well. In terms of, I was brokenhearted and spiritually bankrupt and just felt very lost and sort of angry at God for allowing this to happen. Of course, you blame shift, and there has to be someone to blame. And so I'm blaming God. I'm blaming my father. And I'm also realizing that I'm caught in this place. And I think this happens all the time to pastors, or to people in ministry where, wait a minute, this isn't fair. I'm having a failing here and an issue I can't overcome, but it's attached to my making a living. And I was afraid that if I came out and I'm really honest, that I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to lose projects, you know? So I kind of, you know, it's a great question, and I don't know if my answer is very clear, but I think as alcoholics, you know, we muddle through with a combination of denial and blame shifting to other people to make it okay. And at the same time, paradoxically, it wasn't okay, and I was mortified and horribly ashamed.
Bill, we see a process that happens. We have a good skill set to keep our addiction going. The blame shifting, the dishonesty, the double life.
Aren't those techniques, George? Aren't those techniques we're applying and not and avoiding the real subject?
They are, but what happens is when we get sober and we see what we're doing, there are some skill sets there that we can turn positive.
Okay.
But we have this survival thing going again. We drank to survive, even though it was killing us. And when we get early in recovery, and sometimes if we get out of the word, late in recovery, like I do, that I start getting dishonest and resentful and afraid, and I start manipulating and controlling. That's God's job. I'm responsible for the effort. He's got the outcome. And it's a process. That's why it's real recovery. We're all in a process. We don't arrive.
Right. Heather, another question we have is, would you talk a little bit about the difference that you find in recovery groups and the level of honesty and transparency you can have there versus in churches?
Yeah. You know, I hear from a lot of readers on this topic. And there's one particular passage in my book that I have heard quoted back to me so many times that I finally wrote an entire blog post about it because I think it hit a nerve. And I said something like that I was finally – I didn't quite understand yet when I got in early recovery. I was looking at the closeness and community and fellowship, and I couldn't figure it out how they could be so close, a bunch of addicts and alcoholics, compared to what I had experienced at church, and that it occurred to me eventually that people bond more deeply over shared brokenness than they do over shared beliefs. And I think that when I wrote that on my blog, I think it got 2,000 plus hits, you know. I mean, and I think it's because a lot of Christians recognize the truth in that, that when we are gathering together, there's only, I mean, I love my church and I go to church, and there's a certain kind of community I find at church. But what tends to happen in too many churches is that when we come on the basis of shared belief, the highest value becomes conformity to those beliefs. And I think in that situation, we don't feel we're not able to be as vulnerable. We're not able to deal with our questions and doubts. We're not able to be honest about, because we can't seem to live out and live up to these beliefs that we all share and are trying to conform to. And I think in recovery groups, and I've been in more than one kind of recovery group, I think generally, I experience a way more of an intense community and connection there. And I think a part of it is that what brings us together is this shared brokenness. And in our shared brokenness, we, you know, just to walk in a recovery meeting is to say, I need your help. Something in me is not working. But to walk into a church is to say, I believe the right things. And so I think that that difference explains for me some of why I experience a lot more intimacy in my recovery. And like I said, I think both are important. And, you know, church isn't there for recovery, and recovery isn't church. And I think it's important not to expect the same of both. But having both of those together really helps me a lot.
Heather, would it be fair to say that perhaps my beliefs are who I want to be and my brokenness is really who I am?
Oh, I think that's so well said. And I think, you know, without worshiping on at the altar of pain or at the altar of brokenness, I think that, you know, we are always to some extent broken, and that we do heal, and there is hope, and we do get better, but we are never going to be, like, completely done with that journey. And I think we all have, those broken places inside of us. And for me, I think one of the biggest issues for me before I got into recovery and while I was a Christian is that I thought that the main thing that mattered, that faith was all about having right beliefs and right theology and getting all that right. And if I got all that right, then I would be right with God and things should work for me. And when I got into recovery, I brought all those beliefs in with me, but I began to recognize, oh, you can have all the right beliefs about God and have no clue how to, like, in your soul, absolutely depend on his power. And so it was really these people in recovery who I initially looked down on who showed me what it meant to trust God, even if or you don't completely understand or have all the right answers, because a lot of them weren't confident that they knew everything right about God. What they were confident of is that they leaned on this God that they were hoping existed, that he was coming through for them, and then they could trust him. And then they began to build ideas and beliefs about this God that they could trust.
I like that a lot, Bill. Sometimes what happens to me in church, and Heather, I'll go hear a great sermon and go, yeah, you know, I should be doing that. But I don't know how to do it. I agree with it. I should do it. I kind of want to do it most of the time, but I don't know how to do it. And when I talk about how broken I am with other people, they go, well, hey, have you tried doing it this way? Recovery groups can be more practical in practice than just a set of beliefs, for me anyway.
Exactly, because we talk a lot about different tools, and we use tools. And I think, you know, you're talking about step 11 here, and I love the focus on prayer and meditation. And I never, you know, I used to pray a lot. I prayed a lot, you know, and I had lists of people I prayed for, and I prayed for God's will for all these different people, but I always assumed I kind of knew what that was and would pray for that. But in recovery, I learned to move the whole thing from my head down into my soul. And I think that's where the disconnect is for a lot of us, is our brain tends to be where the problem is, and I think it's where our ego lives, is in our thoughts, and our thinking gets so messed up. And when our whole spiritual life is in our head, and I'm one of those people, because I'm a writer, a lot of it's in my head, there's always this need for me to sit and to have quiet with God and to, you know, breathe and to just be with God and to pay attention consciously to what's happening in my heart and in my soul, those things I can't name, but to just open up my soul and invite God's work there. Because I, you know, the gap between what I know in my head and how I live my life, there's so much despair there sometimes, because I know a whole lot, but getting it out into your life, you know, and that gap can lead me to despair. And then God will always remind me, no, that gap is my opportunity that I fill that gap with my grace. That's all grace.
Heather, it's like reading 10 books about how to swim and then falling in off the dock and drowning, because although you knew a lot about it, you never did it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was a great analogy.
Well, based on that, I think we should take a break because I'm out of good material right now. You listen to Real Recovery. We'll be back in just a minute. We have one more segment with Heather Kopp. Thanks for joining us tonight. Welcome back, everybody, to Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. We're talking to Heather Kopp, author, blogger, communicator exceptionnelle. She is just a delight. God takes the most messed up lives and makes them into objects of his grace. Heather, I have a question for you. Our impulses are always going to be what they are. Our response to them is what we can choose. How did you start choosing differently?
Wow. You know, we talk in recovery about the power of pausing, you know, the power of not responding and reacting and acting on every thought without pausing to think about it and to choose to respond instead of just react. And it took me a long time, and I'm still learning to do that. I'm still learning not to just run on autopilot, you know. And I think for me, this idea of surrender, this idea that that I need to fully turn over my life and my will to the care of God every day, and not every day, every moment, it continues to grow for me. And I think that yeah, those impulses and inclinations are going to come, but these days I can pretty quickly say, is this what Heather wants, or what does God want?
Mm-hmm.
Because pretty much that's what surrender is I'm saying, God, I trust that you know more than me and that you love me beyond measure, and so I'm going to give you my whole life, and help me do your will. Help me do the next right thing you want me to do. You know, and I just, what I tend to do, and maybe you guys can relate, I just set out and I like tend to just go on autopilot. I have my quiet time. I walk away. I get on autopilot and I proceed to sort of do Heather's will. And I'm pretty good about asking God to help me. I want his power, but I pretty much want his power to do my will. And so, that's a big thing for me, and more I'm trying to think of surrender as a posture in my soul, and I'm asking myself during the day about my posture, and what's my posture? Is my posture gratitude and surrender, or is my posture Heather's just off on her own energy and power doing what she thinks is the next right thing, you know?
Gosh, that's so true, Bill. We start the day off wanting to do God's will, and by the time we get in the car and we're out of the driveway, it's about where we're going, what we want to do, and how we're going to do it, and all the stuff we have in a day. And that power to pause is beautiful. What does God want me to do?
Yeah, Heather, you were basically saying, if I heard you correctly, God, here are the things I would like you to cooperate with me on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I don't mean to do that. I don't intentionally do that.
Oh, yeah, but
God,
I do
becomes
it too.
God becomes Heather's little helper. And it's like, oh, yeah, I need to rely on God's power. And I ask for power, and I try to rely on him. And then I realize, okay, but wait a minute. Is this even God's agenda? And sometimes I don't know, you know. I like to use the serenity prayer. I sort of divide it up into columns. And I often just ask myself, okay, is what I'm facing here an issue where I need the serenity to let go of what I can't control? Is this just something I can't control? I need to let go. Or is this something that I need courage because I need to take action? Or is this something that I don't know which of those two to do? I need wisdom to know the difference. And using those three columns, my husband and I joke with each other, and he'll say, Heather, I think that's column one, something that you can't control. Or sometimes he'll say, you know, this is column three. Let's pray for wisdom. And then I added a fourth column, or maybe my husband did. And the fourth column is, it's none of your business. Because sometimes that's the answer.
Exactly. I have a question about the restoration of intimacy. As, you know, people in your life, you start to push them away, don't you, a little bit? Don't you become a little bit more isolated?
Oh,
because,
man.
Because they start to feel the burden of what you're going through, and they start to keep themselves at a self-preserved distance from you.
Oh,
so the loss of intimacy starts to erode. I mean, you just can't stay in contact with people and stay connected to them because you're so consumed about your own consumption.
Yeah. You know, oh, absolutely. You know, I my life was so tiny, it was the size of a raisin. I mean, and we had people we hung out with as couples, and of course they all drank and all that. But I worked really hard to not have any really close friends because I could not let anybody that close because they might figure out just how much I was drinking. And besides which, friends are such a bother. You know, they want you to remember them and their birthdays and they want you to care and they want, I didn't have time for any of that. I just had time for my drinking. And it was like, why would I want real friends, you know? And literally, I worked to not have them. And that is one of the hugest shifts in my life in recovery, is that now I recognize that connection that we have with friends or with another alcoholic or with our husband, those moments of true intimacy where we feel known and something's passed between us, that's the most important. That's what I want in this whole world more than anything. And those are now the most important things to me. And now I have so many dear, honest, true friends, and it's just night and day. Thank God. Yeah.
And then how has your trust been reestablished with your husband, if I may ask?
Oh, you know, that took a while. It did. I think, you know what, he learned the truth. You know, I told him the truth that after that big morning of surrender and sobbing and told him I needed help. But really, it took a while for me to keep getting the truths got more and more as we went along. I would, like, tell him as much truth as I could bear at the moment. And I think what he did is for the first 6 months or so, he was so excited that I was getting help, so excited about my sobriety, that he was afraid to express his true anger or to really deal with the fact that he was now in recovery too, because he'd been living with a rageful, our marriage had been really on the rocks. And, but once I had a relapse at 6 months. And after that relapse, we got into this horrible relapse and fight. For some reason, that triggered his anger as I tried to get sober again. And he felt permission, I think. And we kind of stumbled forward on new ground. I realized that, A, I have to get a sponsor. I have to do the work. I have to work at this. I'm not special. I'm not smart. I'm not a Christian, so it doesn't matter, you know. And then he kind of really joined me in that, too, and he began to come to some recovering meetings with me, and we began to have that shared language, and that helped a ton because he began to understand what was happening. And he began to understand, you know, what I was up against, and I think that helped him forgive me. And, of course, I had to beg his forgiveness and give him a lot of permission to tell me honestly how he felt, and he eventually felt safe enough to do that.
That's a great story. Bill, what happens sometimes is we have little setbacks that really set the table for future honesty, and they're painful to go through. But if you really have the faith and you want to work through this, if you stay sober and are walking with God, that trust comes back, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. So much comes back, and it's so much better. I mean, our marriage, because of the tools that I have learned in recovery and that Dave has learned alongside me, we have both, I mean, it's done so much for our marriage. It's done so much, too, for our spiritual life and our Christian life and our life in our church. And it's just done nothing but good. And I tell people, it sounds sappy, but I've never been so happy in my entire life as I have these past 7 years. And I thought it was going to be the opposite. I thought, I'll never be happy again. I'm going to have to quit drinking, and I'm going to have to, how am I going to live with the misery? And instead, I'm just so grateful, and I just wish I'd gotten sober sooner.
I love that. We will see that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace.
Yeah.
And there is no peace apart from Jesus. And when everything's lost, Bill, when it's hopeless, we reach out and the living God is there. What a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, you guys. I just appreciated it so much. And in case any of your readers are interested, soberboots.com is my blog. And I'm not blogging right now, but usually I am. I'm on summer break.
Well, George isn't blogging either right now, and never has. He did try journaling once, and he went to a coffee shop to journal, and he ended up just copying off the guy's journal next to him.
Oh, yeah.
So
That's too funny.
Well, I mean, George and I are most proud
first
of our...
First time you hear it, it is, yeah.
George and I are most proud of our low self-esteem.
You guys are so great.
You're nice. You're nice.
Thank you.
You're such an encouragement.
Absolutely.
And, in Hebrews 3:13 it says, but encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Heather, my friend, you have done that tonight for us. You've encouraged many, including us in the studio.
Absolutely. Aww. Thanks, Heather.
I hope so. Thank you so much for having me, and I'll come back anytime you want.
And just a reminder for our listeners, you're at heatherkopp.com, is that correct?
Yeah, it's heatherkopp.com or soberboots.com. Both of them will take you to my blog.
Perfect, and they can get lots. And I've been on your blog, and it's very inspirational and lots of good stuff. So thanks so much for being such a great guest.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks to Alex and George. It's been a great evening with Heather. And
absolutely. Thanks, Heather.
We appreciate listening to the show tonight, and I hope you have a great week. Thanks for joining us on Real Recovery. Have a great week. Good night, and God bless. Hi, I'm Bill Arnold with George Fraser.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for checking out this podcast of Real Recovery. You can hear the show live Sundays at 5 p.m. This, as well as many other podcasts, are available to listen to while you take a walk or do whatever you want to do. The address is myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening.